6 minutes to one. You're listening to James O'Brien on LBC. And if you're kind enough to have listened for a while, or you've listened to a lot of shows, what would you sort of point out as some of the most difficult but important conversations that we've had together? It would, for me, be the child sexual abuse stories that we've heard together on the programme, not in the context initially of private schools or boarding schools, but initially in the context of the VIP allegations that some of which remain live, but which of course have been in some ways held below the waterline by the alleged dishonesty of some of the key accusers. I'm going to steer you towards the private school element of the conversation. I'm joined by Alex Renton, who's written a book that many of you mentioned to me on Friday. I was already aware of it, Stiff Upper Lip, in which he examines, well, his own story and the much wider proliferation, you'd have to say, of these sort of vile crimes. And I'm also talking to Alex because, as I mentioned to you last week, the joint headmaster at my prep school got sent to prison on Thursday, and I really liked him. Mm-hmm. The difficulty I had in talking to you about that, in the same way that I spoke to you about the photography teacher who got sent to prison 4 years ago, who I look back on with nothing but disgust and summarily despise, put me in a really weird position where I couldn't tell you the name of the teacher that got sent to jail last week because it would have felt disloyal. I'll tell you now, his name was David Hutchings. We called him Hutch, and he's been sent down for 4.5 years for crimes committed against two of my school friends. Can I begin with that question, Alex? Mm-hmm. Processing the fact, and I wasn't abused mm-hmm. in any way, actually. The guy, this particular guy, was a great inspiration to me and a wonderful teacher. Mm. So it was very difficult for me to process that. Do you understand?
No, absolutely I do. And I mean, one of the reasons I wrote this book is because of the hundreds of stories and allegations that came to me after I first told about what had happened to me at my prep school and to my friends 3 years ago in a newspaper. And often, because with that amount of data, you can begin to see the patterns and put things together, it was often the most likeable, most effective, most human teachers who turned out also to be the ones who would single out one child and abuse them. And I think you have to see this both in the context of a modus operandi and also the fact that everyone, lots of people have a good and a bad side, and a great teacher may have a terrible side to them. And so I've heard stories like yours before.
I'm sure you have, and you refer to where the book came from. I presume, in fact I know, that you were staggered by the kind of the Pandora's box that you opened, or floodgates that you opened when you went public with your own experiences of abuse, to be contacted by so many people who'd been through similar, if not borderline identical, experiences.
I was staggered. I mean, I think, you know, I've been an investigative reporter for 30 years. I mean, I knew that the scale of child abuse within institutions was bigger than any of us had really touched on, that it would be so rife, as rife, and, you know, I and other journalists have had to conclude, in the school, in the care homes for the very rich, as it was for the care homes for the poor. That really blew me away. I'm still shocked by it.
That's a wonderful way of putting it, the care homes for the very rich, because of course that's not the popular perception, and there is a suspicion in some quarters that because we are seen as so privileged, the level of concern is not the same as it would be. I don't know if this holds true, actually, because the level of concern for people who aren't privileged seems to have been shamefully low over the decades. But there's a sense, one fellow who found me last week said they wrote about the abuse at his school and ended the article with the line, and the school has a 9-hole golf course.
Yeah, I think I know the school you're talking about, actually. But yes, I mean, what was clearly true is that the failures of regulation and oversight from the state were different in the schools, in the schools, the private schools, because the private schools had worked very hard to make sure the state wasn't allowed in to have a look. Yes. But that the scale of the problems, and that sex offenders or predators on children deliberately went into these institutions and then were then, to greater or lesser extent, tolerated in them. I think that's the same whatever kind of childcare institution you look at.
This is a personal opinion on your part, obviously. It's not something that can be evidentially backed up, but you've more experience of these issues than anybody, frankly, should have to have. How likely is it that these adults could be operating in an environment where none of the other adults knew what was going on, the adults who were not involved?
I find it impossible to believe, really. I mean, all of us who've worked in institutions or been at schools know how intimate these organisations are, and how particularly the sort of prep schools that you and I went to are often remote in the countryside, an old country house. I mean, everyone knew everything.
You just described my prep school, and I know a lot of the lads are listening to this as well, and what we found is we have a Facebook group that has only been set up in the last month, but it's been an astonishingly cathartic experience, including the lads who are quite open about what happened to them. So not everyone is.
Yeah.
Yes. And there's two things that have popped up during our deliberations. One is that we were all groomed without realising it.
I think that's true, and also the parents were groomed. I mean, my mother, who I've discussed this with at great length and who's now read the book and taken it very bravely on the chin, she was defrauded by an extremely wealthy, well-known school, huge reputation. Queen's nephew was there at the same time as me. And what I've been able to show in the book is that not only did they defraud and mislead parents for decades, because there are stories from the 1940s and the 1950s as well as the 1970s, but that it's very like many of the other institutions. It's almost as though there was a manual for how to run a private school.
Yes.
And how to cover up scandal.
I don't know anyone who hasn't got a story.
No, exactly.
Which is, breathtaking. People listening to this who haven't had a dog in the private school race, or the boarding school race, more pertinently, not exclusively, but boarding just provides such a dangerous environment for this to happen. They'll be screaming at the radio now, absolutely convinced that it could never have happened to their child on their watch. And yet, the country's full of mums and dads who are just as loving and just as devoted and just as committed as I'm sure your mum is, and yet it happened to their sons.
Yes, absolutely. And I think they were misled by their culture. They were misled by a belief that maybe suffering was a good thing for children, that it produced better leaders. That was certainly true. When my parents' grandparents were at school in the same sort of schools in the Victorian age, it was certainly believed that, a bit of hardship made you better. And I think that's still very strong in Britain today, in ideas about how children should be brought up. But I think, just on the wider sense of that society knew, there's some really interesting research that I quote in the book from 1969, a sociologist called Royston Lambert, who interviewed 1,100 children privately, and 6% of them, this is for the government, in boarding schools, 6% of them reported that sexual abuse or sexual approaches from adults within the schools, and this was covered up in 1969. So it's not as though it wasn't known.
Because partly people didn't think it was such a big deal. They didn't think it was damaging. I've got a friend who was educated by the Christian Brothers and insists to this day that having his genitals interfered with while sitting on a priest's knee didn't do him any harm at all. And one hopes he's right, and you don't want the kind of scales to somehow fall from his eyes and him to be hit with the trauma of realizing that it has affected him. But that was a commonplace perception. It was just we even gave them nicknames reflecting their perversions, as if it was the same as being particularly tall or fat.
I remember one of my sisters talking about her prep school, and my mother talking about how nice the music master was there, and he was a charming man who, as you said earlier, everyone liked and benefited from. But my sister said, "But we did call him Fingers, Mum."
Oh, Lord above!
But no, I think that the toleration was there. I think also, again, in my experience of all these anecdotes and allegations that come to me, it's pretty clear that some people, and I may have done this myself a bit, have slightly sidelined their sexual abuse because the neglect and the psychological abuse that arises just from being sent away from love at 8 years old was actually more damaging.
So that's such a tough listen for mums. My mum will be listening to this, and I was a little bit older than you, and I didn't go that far from home, and I begged and begged and begged to be sent to board, and it went against all of her instincts. And yet that phrase there, to be sent away from love.
Absolutely, and sent away from, well, another thing, sent away from safety, and also from trust, because of course the story that comes up again and again, and it was true of me, is that when things went wrong, we didn't tell our parents because children like to protect their parents. Children don't like their parents to feel. Children think their parents are innocent in some ways as well. And anyone who wants to address this problem going forward has to take on that fact that the bravery of children can sometimes help the predators operate.
That was the second strand, actually, a slightly different variation on that, which we wonder whether or not that code, and this is not confined to private schools. My friend Scott got in touch on Friday to say at his comprehensive in Uxbridge it was snitches get stitches. Yes. But the public school variation on that is that you never tell. I remember my own housemaster telling me, I can't remember what I was reporting, but I thought it was a really big deal. And he said, no one likes a tittle-tattle, no one likes a telltale. And we wondered whether or not that is actually not a coincidence, whether or not the institutional nature of this sort of abuse inculcates the idea that anyone who speaks up is problematical rather than looking for solutions.
Well, I think that that certainly was part of the training. I mean, and it's from reading back into history, you can see that that code, that what happens in the team stays within the team, was rife or possibly universal in the schools, but also it then spread into the institutions that the people who ran the schools went on to be in charge of. I mean, clearly, if you were a whistleblower in the NHS when Jimmy Savile was operating, you lived in fear of losing your job.
And how big a role has Jimmy Savile played in what you've unearthed? Because I know that the prosecutions I've referred to from my own past, and that, actually, do you know, I tell you, you will appreciate this, although it's very grim humour. And I mentioned on air last week that another one of my teachers had been sent down, and Tom Perry, who runs Mandate Now, I'm sure you've come across him, a really wonderful man. He tweeted the article that he thought I was referring to, but that was a different teacher at my next school. That's just how...
Yes, this is how rife it was.
Isn't it incredible? But the this notion that they teach you that to press a button in any way or to raise the alarm is part of their success.
Yes, I think that's right. And I think one of the richest experiences as someone who's able to tell some people's stories or filter them through is letting people know it's all right to speak up. Because that is the first and most effective therapy, and to let the light in.
That's the weirdest thing, for want of a better word, about doing it on the radio, because we've done in a very small way what you've done on an epic scale in your book. And it is, someone rings a radio station, and, just shy of a million people listening, and says, I've never told anyone this before. There's a sense of, I don't know quite what the word is, but...
Well, it's liberation,
I think, isn't it? That's
it?
Exactly the word.
Because you finally, after... I mean, I had a wonderful experience. I was in court a bit like you, 2 months ago, watching the first of the teachers from my school up on charges, and he didn't abuse me, but my friends were there, and he got 12 years. That moment where, at last, authority is listening, and that's I don't think revenge is good therapy often, but that notion that justice can finally be had only 40 years on is a huge empowerment.
Which is the question I was about to ask you about the role Jimmy Savile's played in that process. We'll come to after the travel news. The time now is 12:46. You're listening to James O'Brien on LBC, joined by Alex Renton, author of the quite breathtaking book Stiff Upper Lip, which covers the institutional abuse of children in private schools, mostly boarding schools in Britain over the last, four decades? Well, it goes back
further. Well, it go back to 1850 in this book.
1246. 10 minutes to one is the time. Alex Renton's book, Stiff Upper Lip, is in all bookshops now. If you want to understand anything about institutional abuse, it's required reading, but it's not the only upshot of your journeys into this dark, dark territory, Alex, because you now also operate a database that allows people to, ask you questions to which you can provide pretty powerful answers.
Yeah, I mean, the thing is, people write to me and tell their stories, and I think that of itself is great, but I'm not a therapist.
No.
And sadly, as a journalist, I have great trouble finding people to fund the sort of investigations you need to do, because newspapers are strapped for cash.
Yes.
But what I do is log, with people's permission, anonymously, what they tell me and names, and then look for cross-references. And I have managed to help people get together, connect people from schools who are looking to form groups or just to support each other. And I think that provably has been useful.
Absolutely. The reason I was going to ask about Jimmy Savile is because I wondered how big a role that's played in bringing people forward. I know one of our cases at my prep school was prompted by the thought, as you said, they're taking me seriously now. Mm. They're taking these people seriously. And although you've got newspaper columnists like Richard Littlejohn ending his articles with lines like, "And Jimmy Savile is still dead," which is a sort of almost stone-cold depiction of the ignorance that stops people coming forward. It, 40 years, 40 minutes, in many ways, justice remains the same.
Yes, no, that's right.
And Savile did prompt people, give people confidence.
And there's also a key partly because of Savile, also because of Tom Perry and the Caldecott School survivors' work, that they got the law changed. So it's now possible for people to sue. It, there used to be a cut-off date of just a few years, but now you can sue in civil cases, and that's really important because it, it brings people some comfort and some chance of getting something back, but it also warns the institutions that they won't get away with it.
They
and it warns their insurance companies, because the insurers are going to have to go, actually, you need to protect children properly.
Cynical but effective.
Yeah, very effective. So Savile and you know, the great fight from the survivors of that and Caldecott School brought about this crucial change in the law.
And that has hopefully given you hope for the future. Have you? I mean, things are a lot better now than they used to be. Most of the stories we come across are quite historical. It's 10 years ago, 15 years ago, 20 years ago, but it remains.
Most not all. I mean,
Yeah, most not all.
I mean, you know, London International School 2 years ago and so on. I mean, cases come up and up again and again. There is still an institutional laziness and incompetence.
Why do you think the boarding schools are strapped for cash. Yes, oh, I see.
Teachers who want to do the job very badly are cheap. The fail-safes aren't there, and we still don't have what Tom Perry calls for, which is mandatory reporting in a clear way, so whistleblowers really can know what to do.
Just to explain exactly what that is, because I know there's a lot of confusion, and including some would argue the NSPCC don't have a proper handle on what mandatory reporting is.
They don't. Well, mandatory reporting is the duty, if an allegation comes forward, to make sure someone outside the institution knows about it.
So it's not enough for the headmaster to say, don't worry, Mr. Blenkinsop, we're on top of that. And then sometimes the teacher might disappear in the night, but justice hasn't been served. Absolutely. The teacher has just disappeared in the night.
And that's true again and again in our schools, where the teacher gets slapped on the wrist, the parents are placated, and the teacher leaves with a reference to go and work elsewhere.
You mentioned your own mum. How much contact have you had with parents? Because some of them must be shouldering burdens that are I'm not comparable to being a survivor, but the idea that you... Yeah. For me, it was... And I think we all see these stories perhaps through the lens of our own experiences. For me, it was my school friends that were abused. But I was very conscious of what a sacrifice going to that kind of school involved for my parents. We're very not one of those families for whom it was a rite of passage. And I was the third or fourth generation. Yeah. I was real sacrifice on the part of my father to give me the start in life that he hadn't had. And he'd seen the benefits when he got to Fleet Street that kind of background could give.
Yeah.
And so if I had... turned around. I got my head kicked in by a teacher once, but my dad knocked him out. That's a story I'll save for you for another day.
But if I
had been abused in this way, that you touched on that, and I hadn't thought of it before, that you'd be going back to your mum and dad and saying, you know that golden ticket that you have slaved and scrimped and strived to buy for me? Well, look what it got me.
Yes.
Parents must really struggle with this.
No, absolutely. And I think parents, we were saying, children like to protect their parents. And to know that you've had this great opportunity and that parents have gone without a car or a washing machine or a foreign holiday to let it happen, and then for it to go wrong.
Yeah.
And this, you know, this informs the awful stories around the football academies.
Yeah.
Same thing. Great, you know, the greatest chance of your life. You get out of your suburb and into Newcastle United's football academy. You're then going
so
to say
much
that
to
it's
aim
all,
for.
All
yes.
wrong. So that weight that parents put on children, even when trying to love them as well as they possibly can and buy the best for them, you know, it can be a burden they can't take.
How have you personally been helped by this mission, if indeed you have?
I think I get a lot of pleasure from the fact that I get letters from people who go, you've told me it's all right to talk,
yeah,
and that's great. And I've started talking. I'm talking to my partner, and that's wonderful. Occasionally, I've been able to be part of group or enable groups to go forward and start criminal investigations going. That's very pleasing. I mean, in terms of my own unhappiness, I dealt with that before I started this process. But dealing with that was beginning to acknowledge what had happened to me when I was 8 years old and after, and understand that and share that with my wife and family. And that, so it's been maybe a 15, 20-year process, but I'm a very lucky man in that I've been able to arrive at a place where I think I've dealt with it and I'm happy.
And that's wonderful to know, very wonderful to know, and very encouraging for a lot of people listening. And I don't want to oversimplify anything, and by all means tell me if I am veering into that sort of territory. But it, in terms of the lasting hurt that is caused, what are the sort of common factors? What would you recognise in another survivor? What is the kind of examples of the The less obvious scars, perhaps.
I think if you go on to, you know, some very good sites around like Boarding Concern and Boarding School Survivors who lay out the symptoms, and, you know, most of us can tick them off, and they involve, you know, anger problems, depression, you know, inability to form healthy relationships and so on, often experimenting with risk-taking behaviours, people call it. But I think the thing that strikes me most and the thing I regret most about what happened to me after that experience is the collateral damage I caused. The people who I didn't love as they deserved, the places I lashed out and so on. And some of the saddest stories I get are from children of boarding school men and women, from the spouses who tried for 30 years to make a marriage work and so on. And the fact this misery, it grows and grows, it deepens like a coastal shelf, as the poet puts it. What those men mainly did to us had huge and life-lasting effects across great groups of people.
And people may not realise. They may not realise that their depression has its roots in their childhood. They may not realise that their anger management issues have their roots in their childhood. And talking about it is the first step towards...
Yes.
Recovery.
And talking about and rejecting this stiff upper lip message they were given that you grin and bear it. Don't grin and bear it, you talk about
it. You talk about it.
And that helps everyone around you.
I love, finally, because I know Sheila Fogarty will appreciate this, you have a theory about journalism and these sort of schools, don't you?
Well, it's interesting because I think you're an example, I'm an example, there are lots around us. Growing up sceptical of adults and questioning of adult rules and authority and going, well, actually, I don't believe you because you're a violent creep, turns you into someone who questions all authority. And that's, you know, that is the life of a good journalist, I think.
It's a silver lining of sorts, but a scant one. Yeah. Alex Renton, it's been a pleasure. And thank you for all the work you've done, especially on behalf of, I don't want to get emotional, but some of my friends will be listening to this now.
Oh, thanks.
Cheers.